If you get to be 65 or 70 and later, and the people that you want to have love you actually do love you, you're a success. I've never seen anybody that reaches that age. I mean, I'm not talking about somebody that's in extreme poverty or pain or something, but I've never seen anybody that, if they have a lot of people that love them, that is other than happy. And I've seen some very, very wealthy people that they give testimonial dinners to and name schools after and everything. Nobody loves them, you know. By far the best investment you can make is in yourself. I mean, for example, communication skills. I tell the students that come that they're going to graduate schools and business, and they're learning all these complicated formulas and all that. If they just learn to communicate better, and both in writing and in person, they increase their value at least 50%. And, you know, I mean, if you can't communicate, somebody says, you know, it's like winking at a girl in the dark. Nothing happens, you know, basically. And you have to be able to get forth your ideas. And that's relatively easy. I did it myself with the Dale Carnegie course. Some people wish I'd taken a shorter course now in terms of my talking later on. But it's just hugely important. And if you invest in yourself, nobody can take it away from you. The second thing, which I'll get a certain criticism for not living it, but I do tell those students, you know, that if I gave you a car and it'd be the only car you get in the rest of your life, you'd take care of it like you can't believe it. Any scratch you'd fix that moment, you'd read the owner's manual, you'd keep a garage and do all these things. And you get exactly one mind and one body in this world. And you can't start taking care of it when you're 50. By that time, you'll have rusted out if you haven't done anything. So you should really make sure that you just remember that you just got one mind and body to get through life with and to do the most with it.
What about life advice?
Well, life advice is, you know, the most important thing, aside from the things I've talked about already, is really who you associate with. You want to associate with people that are better than you are. I mean, basically, you'll go in the direction of the people that you associate with. And you want to have the right heroes. You want people, if you want to emulate somebody, you better pick very carefully who you want to emulate. And obviously, you can't pick your parents. They're going to have enormous influence on you, but you don't get a choice on that. But you get choices as you go down the line. And you, who you admire, who you want to copy. And the most important for most people in terms of that decision is their spouse. It's also important in terms of a partner in business, but the partner in life is the most important one. You want to pick a spouse that's better than you are. And then he or she, and you hope they don't figure it out too fast.
Is business school worth it?
Depends on the person. Much more than it depends on the school. I mean, I wouldn't worry. Some people are going to get a lot out of advanced education, and some people are going to get very little. And I don't even think it's important that every person go to college at all. I mean, we have all kinds of jobs at 70 or so thousand a year, 80,000 a year, that college training is not of use. And I actually was not keen on going to college.
Really?
Myself. Yeah, my dad kind of jollied me into it. He could get me to do anything. If they'd had an SAT test in those days, he would have taken the test for me. But because I knew I could have a good time, and I liked investing, and I didn't really feel I could read the books. So I don't, you know, it's a big commitment to take 4 years, and the cost involved, and maybe the loans involved, and everything. And I think, depending on what your interests are in life, I don't think it's for everybody. I think it's for a lot of people. But there ought to be a reason you're going. And I didn't really see much reason.
It never bothered me if people disagreed with what I thought, as long as I felt I knew the facts. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things I don't know a thing about. I just stay away from those. So I stay within what I call my circle of competence. You know, Tom Watson said it best. He said, I'm no genius, but I'm smart in spots, and I stay around those spots. Well, I try and stay around those spots. And I just don't have a problem if somebody says, you know, you're wrong on something. I go back and look at the facts, and I think that really is much more important, frankly, than having a few points of IQ or having an extra course or two in school or anything of the sort. You need emotional stability.
I just read and read and read. I probably read 5 to 6 hours a day. I don't read as fast now as when I was younger, but
I read 5 daily newspapers. I read a fair number of magazines. I read 10Ks. I read annual reports. And I read a lot of other things, too. So I've always enjoyed reading. I love reading biographies. Famous lesson about a margin of safety, that you don't drive a truck that weighs 9,900 pounds across a bridge that says limit 10,000 pounds, because you can't be that sure about it. If you see something like that, you go down a little further down the road and you find one that says limit 20,000 pounds, and that's the one you drive across. The nature of capitalism is that people want to come in and take your castle. Perfectly understandable. I mean, if I'm selling television sets or something, there's going to be 10 other people that are going to try and sell a better television set. If I have a restaurant here in Omaha, people are going to try and copy my menu and give more parking and take my chef and so on. So capitalism's all about somebody coming and trying to take the castle. Now, what you need is you need a castle that has some durable competitive advantage, some castle that has a moat around it. And that moat, best, one of the best moats in many respects, is to be a low-cost producer. But sometimes the moat is just having more talent. I mean, if you're the heavyweight champion of the world and you keep knocking out people, you've got a competitive advantage as long as you can keep doing it. And it's very profitable if you're the one that happens to be able to do it. If you can turn out great motion pictures, I mean, you know, Steven Spielberg, I mean, he's a fellow to bet on, and it has enormous economic value. What kills great businesses, if you look at, I do believe in looking at history, and I like to study failure, actually. And my partner says, all I want to know is where I'll die, so I'll never go there. And we want to see what has caused businesses to go bad. And the biggest thing that kills them is complacency. I mean, you want a restlessness, a feeling that, you know, that somebody's always after you, but you're going to stay ahead of them. You always want to be on the move. When you've got a great business, you know, like Coca-Cola, which is, there aren't any like Coca-Cola, but the danger would always be that you rest on your laurels. But I see none of that, obviously, at Coca-Cola. But that is the key, to compete the same way when you've got 1.8 billion servings being sold daily as when you were selling, you know, 10 a day. And that restlessness, that belief that tomorrow is more exciting than today. You know, you just have to have it permeate the organization.
Who was Ben Graham? He was your primary mentor, model?
He was a wonderful man, and he was my professor at Columbia. I read his book when I was 19 at the University of Nebraska, and I'd started investing when I was 11, and I started reading about it when I was like 7. So I'd gone through all, I read every book in the Omaha Public Library that was on by the time I was 12 on investing and stock market. And I had a lot of fun, but I never really found out, I never got grounded in anything. And it was entertaining, but it wasn't going to be profitable. And then I read Graham's book, The Intelligent Investor, when I was at the University of Nebraska.
And pulled it
that
all
just
together.
Opened the whole thing up to me. Yeah, and I named my oldest son is named Howard after my dad, Graham Buffett. And he was a marvelous man. Never expected anything from me in return.
You have given a lot of fabulous advice, but what's the best advice that you've ever received?
Well, I received it in a variety of forms, particularly from my father when I was very young. But I mean, he basically, I think, taught me how to live. Not that I did it perfectly or anything like that, but I mean, he was giving me lessons, but he wasn't doing it by preaching to me. He was doing it by example. But basically, well, the biggest lesson, in a sense, I got is the power of unconditional love. I mean, I think there is no power on earth like unconditional love. I think that if you offer that to your child, I mean, you're 90% of the way home, and maybe days when you don't feel like it. It's not uncritical love. That's a different animal. But to know you always can come back, I mean, that is huge in life. That takes you a long, long way. And I would say that every parent out there that can extend that to their child at a very young age, it's going to make for a better human being.
And you felt like you got that kind of unconditional love from your dad?
I absolutely did, yeah.
It is a powerful thing.
It is a powerful thing.
To get something you never had, you have to do something you never did. Les Brown's a motivational speaker. He made an analogy about this. He says, imagine you're on your deathbed, and standing around your deathbed are the ghosts representing your unfulfilled potential. The ghost of the ideas you never acted on. The ghost of the talents you didn't use. And they're standing around your bed, angry, disappointed, and upset. They say, we came to you because you could have brought us to life, they say. And now we have to go to the grave together. So I ask you today, how many ghosts are going to be around your bed when your time comes? Put God first. Put God first in everything you do. Everything that you think you see in me, everything that I've accomplished, everything that you think I have, and I have a few things. Everything that I have is by the grace of God. 40 years ago, March 27th, 1975, it was 40 years ago, just this past March, I was flunking out of college. I had a 1.7 grade point average. I was sitting in my mother's beauty parlor, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I see behind me this woman under the dryer. Every time I looked up, she was looking at me, just looking me in the eye. And I didn't know who she was, and I said, you know, she said, somebody give me a pen, give me a pencil, I have a prophecy. March 27, 1975, she said, boy, you are going to travel the world and speak to millions of people. Now, mind you, I was flunked out of college. I'm thinking about joining the army. I didn't know what I was going to do. And she's telling me I'm going to travel the world and speak to millions of people. Well, I have traveled the world and I have spoke to millions of people. But that's not the most important thing, the success that I had. The most important thing is that what she taught me and what she told me that day has stayed with me since. I've been protected. I've been directed. I've been corrected. I've kept God in my life and has kept me humble. I didn't always stick with him, but he always stuck with me. So stick with him in everything you do. If you think you want to do what you think I've done, then do what I've done and stick with God. Fail big. That's right. Fail big. Today is the beginning of the rest of your life, and it can be very frightening. It's a new world out there. It's a mean world out there, and you only live once. So do what you feel passionate about. Take chances professionally. Don't be afraid to fail. There's an old IQ test was 9 dots, and you had to draw 5 lines with a pencil within these 9 dots without lifting the pencil. The only way to do it was to go outside the box. So don't be afraid to go outside the box. Don't be afraid to think outside the box. Don't be afraid to fail big, to dream big. But remember, dreams without goals are just dreams, and they ultimately fuel disappointment. So have dreams, but have goals, life goals, yearly goals, monthly goals, daily goals. I try to give myself a goal every day. Sometimes it's just to not curse somebody out. Simple goals, but have goals. And understand that to achieve these goals, you must apply discipline and consistency. In order to achieve your goals, you must apply discipline, which you have already done, and consistency every day, not just on Tuesday and miss a few days. You have to work at it every day. You have to plan every day. You've heard the saying, we don't plan to fail, we fail to plan. Hard work works. Working really hard is what successful people do. And in this text, tweet, twerk world that you've grown up in, remember, just because you're doing a lot more doesn't mean you're getting a lot more done. Remember that. Just because you're doing a lot more doesn't mean you're getting a lot more done. Don't confuse movement with progress. My mother told me, she said, yeah, because you can run in place all the time and never get anywhere. So continue to strive, continue to have goals, continue to progress. You'll never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. I'll say it again. You'll never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. I don't care how much money you make, you can't take it with you. The Egyptians tried it. They got robbed. That's all they got. You can't take it with you. And it's not how much you have. It's what you do with what you have. We all have different talents. Some of you will be doctors, some lawyers, some scientists, some educators, some nurses. The most selfish thing you can do in this world is help someone else. Why is it selfish? Because the gratification, the goodness that comes to you, the good feeling that I get from helping others, nothing's better than that. Well, one or two things, but nothing's better than that. Not jewelry, not big house I have, not the cars, but it's the joy. That's where the joy is in helping others. That's where the success is in helping others. Finally, I pray that you put your slippers way under the bed tonight so that when you wake up in the morning, you have to get on your knees to reach them. And while you're down there, say thank you for grace. Thank you for mercy. Thank you for understanding. Thank you for wisdom. Thank you for parents. Thank you for love. Thank you for kindness. Thank you for humility. Thank you for peace. Thank you for prosperity. Say thank you in advance for what's already yours. That's how I live my life. That's why I am. One of the reasons why I am today. Say thank you in advance for what is already yours. True desire in the heart for anything good is God's proof to you sent beforehand to indicate that it's yours already. I'll say it again. True desire in the heart, that itch that you have, whatever it is you want to do, that thing that you want to do to help others and to grow and to make money, that desire, that itch, that's God's proof to you, sent beforehand already to indicate that it's yours. And anything you want good, you can have. So claim it. Work hard to get it. When you get it, reach back. Pull someone else up. Each one, teach one. Don't just aspire to make a living. Aspire to make a difference.
Instead of telling you what I think you should be doing, or how you could be better, or I thought, well, let me just speak from the heart, speak from my gut, and really not have anything prepared, but just tell you what's worked for me. And maybe some of the stuff that's worked for me might work for you now, currently, presently, as you guys have your goals and ambitions, but then further on down the line, as you guys continue to live your life. This idea and this notion that you could be anything you want, and you can accomplish anything you want, right? We hear that. You've heard that from the time you were little boys. You hear that now. You're already incredibly accomplished. You guys know that. The thing that has worked for me is to remember the hard times. So, and I'm sure you guys all have your processes. And again, I'm going to tell you what worked for me. So before a big movie comes out, before, back in the days when I was wrestling with WWE, a WrestleMania match, anything big that would happen, I would always take a moment and I'd just remind myself, all right, I was evicted when I was 14. We were kicked off the island. We couldn't live in Hawaii. Had no place to live. A lot of shit happened then when I moved to Nashville. I was arrested multiple times by the time I was 16 years old. I would remember that, and it allows me then to be present in the moment and understand, holy, the stuff I have around me right now, this is the shit that I dreamed of when I was a kid. I am here. I played for University of Miami, played great teams. Warren Sapp, Ray Lewis, they were my teammates. They were balling. Warren Sapp was playing tight end that time. I was starting defensive tackle. Yeah, they moved him over to D-line. And he looked at me, he's like, yo, dude, I'm gonna take your spot. And I said, you ain't taking my spot. He said, I'm gonna take your spot. I said, no, you ain't. We battled, and he took my spot. Now, you can imagine how that f***ed with me, because there goes my opportunity. He went in, switched a defensive tackle, lit the world on fire. Well, what that did, it crushed me, it crushed my dreams. I had a piss-poor senior year, zero production, no NFL, no combine invite, nothing. Finally went to the CFL, Calgary Stampeders, making $250 a week Canadian. Canadian. Now, I had to send that home to my wife at that time. Had no money. So I remember that. When I got cut from Canada, my dad in his pickup truck came down 4 o'clock in the morning, picked me up in Miami from Tampa. We lived in a little apartment in Tampa. He drove down in his little pickup truck to Miami to get me when I was cut from the CFL. And I thought, well, I leave home like you guys left home. I'm ready to tackle the world, get after it, achieve my dreams and goals. Crushed by 22, 23 years old. Now I gotta move back in with my mom and dad. I played on great teams though. Wait a second, this is not supposed to be my future. I'm supposed to be in the NFL right now. I'm supposed to be making a lot of coin and buying my parents buying me taking care of my wife, but it never happened. So I pulled out my wallet. I thought, well, let me see how much money I have. I opened it up. I had a five, a one, and change. Well, at least I rounded up to $7. But I thought, God, ain't this a bitch? I got $7 in my pocket. Where the f*** do I go now? What do I do? I can't go back to CFL. The point comes where you hear that voice, the big run's over. Like, you're done, right? So I heard that voice. So as Coach was saying, man, I hold on to that. I'm telling you, I keep my back is up against this mother. We laugh, we joke, we have a good time, but my back is still up against this mother. I do not forget it. What this also helps me do, and again, it works for me, is at some point, you gotta be tired of not being number one. You have to be, and you gotta play angry, and I play angry. Now, I'm cool and calm with my approach, and when I step out on my field, which is a set, or, you know, like, there's some, and you're always gonna have haters, and haters are like, well, God damn, man, how many movies are you gonna make, or how much shit are you gonna do? Like, you do a lot of shit. I say, yes, because my ambition, of course, why not? I could do it, yeah. I love what I do. And not only that, but in what world do we not work every day? My back is up against this thing, you know, and I started to play angry, by the way, and I still play angry. My last match, Brock Lesnar, transitioned, and I realized if I had to be great at something, I wanted to be great in this world of Hollywood and movie making and producing and entertainment, I had to commit, and like you guys have to commit. Obviously, you commit to something, commit to the goal. So I quietly retired. 2 years later, I thought, what did I do with my career? Because my movies were not doing well. I was written off. I was like, it was around 2006, 2007. I was like, I left, I pulled a Jim Brown. I left when I was on top, like number one in the wrestling business, and I left. It was a ballsy, gutsy, some call it stupid move, but I had to commit and I had to follow. It was in my gut. What helps me is to keep the hard times in the front of my mind, because it allows me to go into these big moments that I've worked my ass off, and you guys have worked your ass off. It allows me to go into these big moments with a different perspective. What it also does for me, and again, this is what works for me. Like, my back is up against this mother every day. It's against this wall. But it's up against this mother because it's what I believe in. And when my back is against this mother, then there's nowhere to go. But that way, that's it. Doesn't mean you don't smile. Doesn't mean you don't laugh and joke, right? You're happy. I'm happy. I'm a happy guy. But when it comes to business and when it comes to executing, it's up against this. And I gotta go that way. And I don't give a fuck who is in front of me. They're not gonna stop me. The key for me was, where does it start? What's the anchor? What's the anchor? So I could have all these ambitions, and you guys have all these ambitions, which is great. It's important. I'll play this role, you'll play that role. I'll execute this thing and it'll come out this summer. You guys will execute this thing during the summer, right? When it's time to really put in a lot more work. But the key with me is just always finding what the anchor is. And the anchor is getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning every day before anybody else and grounding my thought process is in the no one will outwork me. No one. I love and I respect you guys. Motherfucker won't outwork me. All starts with this. Two hands, putting it to work. As you guys know, there's nothing you can't accomplish. You're gonna go on, you're gonna become world champions. The key for me, what I think one of the keys is, remember where you came from, keep that in the front of your mind, and when goes bad and it goes sideways, a lot of does, you're getting booed out of the building, or you're coming through this injury, or people are writing you off, oh, you guys ain't make it, you know, any of that. You gotta keep it in here. And it really has to, it should drive you. It should. It works for me. It should drive you. You got all the talent in the world. It's all here. Really, the two things I want to say are, you got to be the hardest workers in the room. And don't f*** the opportunity up.
The first thing I would say is that if you're dealing with someone who's depressed and they're really depressed, you should try giving them antidepressants. Because if they die, you can't help them. Okay, so if you're suffering, you are obligated, in a sense, to hold on to whatever rope someone throws you. And one of the things I do with my clients all the time, especially if they're really in trouble, is to tell them, look, I don't know exactly what's going to help you, but don't arbitrarily throw out any possibilities because you might not have that luxury. Antidepressants help a lot of people, and there are technical reasons why that's the case. So that's a simple answer. It's not relevant to what I already described, except that if you're offered a gift by your society and it works, try it. I don't care what your presuppositions are. Apart from that, lots of the time you see people who are suffering with depression, for example. There's a multitude of reasons, but I'll take one common reason. You can think about it as associated with the story of Peter Pan. Now, Peter Pan is someone who won't grow up, right? Now, the problem with Peter Pan is he gets to be king, but it's king of Neverland. Neverland doesn't exist. So being king of nothing isn't that helpful. Well, one of the things that you often see with people who suffer from depression, and I'm not making a blanket statement about the cause of depression because there's lots of them, is that people who don't have enough order in their life tend to get overwhelmed. So for example, if someone comes into me and see me and they say they're depressed, I always ask them a very standard set of questions. Do you have a job? If you don't have a job, you're really in trouble in our society. First of all, your biological rhythms tend to go off the rails right away because there's no reason to go to bed at any particular time and there's no reason to get up. And for many people, if they don't get up at the same time, they foul up the functioning of their circadian rhythms, and that's enough to make them depressed right off the bat, especially if they start napping during the afternoon. They also don't have a purpose. People aren't good without a purpose. And this isn't hypothesizing. We absolutely understand the circuitry that underlies positive emotion. We know how it works. Almost all the positive emotion that any of you are likely to experience in your life will not be a consequence of attaining things. It will be a consequence of seeing that things are working as you proceed towards a goal you value. That's completely different. And you need to know this because people are often stunned, for example, they finish their PhD thesis and their presupposition is that they're going to be elated for a month. And often instead, they're actually depressed and they think, what the hell? I've been working on this for 7 years and I handed it in and what do I do now? And that's what depresses them, right? It's the what do I do now? Well, they're fine if they enjoyed it pursuing the thing. As long as it was working out, they get a lot of enthusiasm and excitement out of that because that's how our nervous systems work. Most of your positive emotion is goal pursuit emotion. If you take drugs like cocaine or amphetamine, the reason they're enjoyable is because they turn on the systems that help you pursue goals. That's why people like them. So if you don't have a job, you got no structure. That's not good. Plus, you tend not to have a point. So you're overwhelmed by chaotic lack of structure and you don't have any positive emotion. Well, do you have any friends? So sometimes you see people who are depressed, they have no job, they have no friends, they have no intimate relationship, they have an additional health problem, and they have a drug and alcohol problem. My experience has been if you have three of those problems, it's almost impossible to help you. You're so deeply mired in chaos that you can't get out because you make progress on one front and one of your other problems pulls you down. So one of the things I tell people who are depressed is like, don't sacrifice your stability. get a job. Even if it's not the job you exactly want, get a damn job. You need a job. Find some friends. Get out in the dating circuit. See if you can establish an intimate relationship. Put together some of the foundational items that are like pillars that your life rests on. Well, that's the practical thing to do. So that's one example with regards to depression. Well, the thing is, you don't just launch it on them, you know. You got to negotiate with the person. And you also got to teach them to negotiate with themselves. And this is something that's very useful to know. You know, you can tyrannize yourself into doing things, but I wouldn't recommend it. What I would recommend instead is that you ask yourself what you're willing to do. It's a really effective technique. It's like a meditative technique. So, for example, you can get up in the morning and you can think, well, you know, I'd like to have a good day today, so I'd like to go to bed tonight without feeling guilty because I, you know, didn't do some things I said I was going to do, and I, you know, I'd like to have kind of an interesting day. So you got to fulfill my responsibilities, and I want to, you know, enjoy the day. Then you can ask yourself, well, okay, what would I have to do in order for that to happen that I would do? And the probability, if you practice this for 3 or 4 days, is your brain will just tell you, it'll say, well, you know, there's that piece of homework that you haven't done for like 3 weeks. You should knock that sucker off because it would only take you 10 minutes and you've been avoiding it and torturing yourself to death for, you know, like 72 hours straight. And if you do that, here's a little interesting thing you can do. And, you know, maybe this is a little obligation you should clean up. And so what you do in a situation like that is you teach the person to negotiate with themselves. Say, well, let's figure out what your aims are. You got to have some aims. Whatever they are. And they might say, well, I'm so depressed I don't have any aims. And then I say, well, pick the least objectionable of the aims and act it out for a while and see what happens. Because sometimes your emotional systems are so fouled up that you have to pretend, you have to act the thing out before you can start to believe it. I mean, people always assume they have to believe and then act, but that's sometimes that's true and lots of times it isn't. So the trick, if you're doing therapeutic work with somebody and you're helping them establish a structure, is to find out what they'll do. Now, if they want to get better, which is not a given, because there are often payoffs for not getting better, that's basically the payoffs of being a martyr, or maybe the payoffs of doing what your entirely pathological family members want you to do because they actually want you to fail. Assuming you want to get better, there's usually something you can figure out that would constitute a step towards some sort of concrete goal. And my presumption, it's a behavioral presumption fundamentally, is that small accruing gains that repeat are unbelievably powerful. So, you know, this is another thing to know about in your own life. It's something I learned in part from reading the writings of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who's a great Russian philosopher and novelist. You know, he said, you can look at your life and you can see what isn't right about it. I mean, all you have to do is look. And then you can start to fix that. And the way you fix it is by noticing what you could in fact fix. You know, people are often trying to fix things they can't fix, which I would not recommend, because if you try to fix something you can't fix, you'll just ruin it. Like, you can find all sorts of undergraduates who are perfectly willing to restructure the international economic system who cannot keep their room clean. And there's actually a gap there, you know, which, and it's surprising that people don't actually notice. So I would say, if you pay attention, you can see things that you could fix. They yell at you. They really do. We even know how that happens. Let me give you an example, because rooms are full of stories, and the stories have effects on you. So here's a classic experiment. So you take two groups of undergraduates, you bring them into your lab, and you give one group a multiple choice test that has a bunch of words in it that are associated with being old, and you give the other group the same multiple choice test, except the words are associated with being young. This is independent of the content of the test. It's just descriptions. And then you time the undergraduates as they walk back to the elevators. The ones who completed the multiple choice test that had more words associated with aging walk slower back to the elevators. And they don't know that. And they don't know they're doing it. And that study's been replicated in various forms many, many times. You're unbelievably sensitive to the story that your environment's telling you. Because your environment is not made out of objects. That's just wrong. Your environment is basically made out of something like tools and obstacles. You're a tool-using creature. You're a tool-perceiving creature. The things you... Like, if I take you out of this room and I say, well, what was in the room? You're not going to say, random patterns in the carpet, because they're real. They're just as good an object as anything else. You're going to say chairs because you can sit on them. And you're going to say handrails because you can hold them. You're going to say stairs because you can walk down them. That's what you see, and that's what you interact with. And if you pay attention to your environment, which is you, by the way, extended, all of your experience is you. It will tell you all the time what you should do. All you have to do is do it. But then you have to decide if you want to do it. One of the things I've noticed about people, because I've wondered, once I started studying these mythological stories and I got this idea about the fact that life can be meaningful enough to justify its suffering, I thought, God, that's such a good idea. Because it's not optimistic exactly. You know, some people will tell you, well, you can be happy. It's like, those people are idiots. I'm telling you, they're idiots. There's going to be things that come along that flatten you so hard you won't believe it. And you're not happy then. And so if life is to be happy, well, in those situations, what are you doing? Why even live? But that isn't, life isn't to be happy. If you're happy, you're bloody fortunate and you should enjoy it. You should, because it's the grace of God, so to speak. With regards to meaning, I thought, well, people know when they're doing something meaningful. They can tell. So why the hell don't they do meaningful things all the time? It seems obvious. You could do it. I mean, it's hard, you know, because other people want you to do other things and it's a struggle, but everything's a struggle. And then I thought, well, oh, I get it. I see why. It took me about 10 years to figure this out. People have a choice. Choice number one, nothing you do means anything. Well, that's kind of a drag, right? It's meaninglessness of life and all that existential angst. You know, that's kind of a pain. But the upside of nothing that you do is meaningful is you don't have to do anything. You've got no responsibility. Now, you have to suffer because things are meaningless, but that's a small price to pay for being able to be completely useless. The alternative is everything you do matters. Really. If you make a mistake, it's a real mistake. If you betray someone, you tilt the world a little more sharply towards evil rather than good. It matters what you do. Well, if you buy that, then you can have a meaningful life. But there's no mucking around. It means responsibility. It means that the decisions you make are important. It means that when you do something wrong, it's wrong. Well, do you want that?
Empowerment is authority. It is a signed permission slip to actually seize the day. It's the process of getting stronger and more confident and more engaged. And to be empowered is to move through the world without any kind of fear or any kind of apology. And with these gifts comes an even deeper privilege, I believe, and that is the ability to take charge of your own life, to own yourself and claim your rights. And here's what I know for sure, that to whom much is given, much is expected. And I have been given so much. I've earned it, I've been blessed with it, but I've been given a lot. And that's why I've chosen to use my life to lift other people up.
Nobody's journey is seamless or smooth. We all stumble, we all have setbacks. If things go wrong, you hit a dead end, as you will. It's just life's way of saying, time to change course. So ask every failure, this is what I do. Every failure, every crisis, every difficult time, I say, what is this here to teach me? And as soon as you get the lesson, you get to move on. If you really get the lesson, you pass and you don't have to repeat the class. If you don't get the lesson, it shows up wearing another pair of pants to give you some remedial work. And what I found is that difficulties come when you don't pay attention to life's whisper, because life always whispers to you first. And if you ignore the whisper, sooner or later, you'll get a scream. Whatever you resist persists, but if you ask the right question, not why is this happening, but what is this here to teach me? What is this here to teach me? It puts you in the place and space to get the lesson you need. My friend Eckhart Tolle, who's written this wonderful book called A New Earth, that's all about letting the awareness of who you are stimulate everything that you do. He puts it like this. He says, don't react against a bad situation, merge with that situation instead, and the solution will arise from the challenge. Because surrendering yourself doesn't mean giving up, it means acting with responsibility.
I have a very big life, and so people with big lives can do big things. And so I started to think about what was the best Christmas I ever had in my life. I grew up poor, on welfare with my mother for part of my life. And I remember that the best Christmas of my life was when I was 12 years old and my mother had said, we're not gonna have Christmas because we can't afford it. I remember feeling like it's going to be really hard on Christmas morning to go outside. What am I going to do when everybody else is outside? That's what I thought. What am I going to do when everybody else is outside? And what am I going to do when I have to go back to class and say I got nothing? So that's what I was mostly worried about. And then some nuns showed up. Some three nuns came to our house, and they gave me a doll, and they bought us food, and we had our Christmas. That was the best Christmas of my life, because somebody remembered, and I wasn't going to have to be the kid that said I got nothing. So I wanted to be able to create that same feeling for children who had nothing. So I decided to go to South Africa. Originally, I wanted to do a million kids, and then just realized I only had 4 weeks vacation. So in 4 weeks, I could not reach a million kids, because I didn't want to just write a check, send a donation. I wanted to be able to look in each kid's face and say to that child, somebody remembered you. And so that's what I did with my life this Christmas. I took 41 people from here, hired another 50 people over there, and we were a traveling caravan from one village to the next. We did 2,000 kids a day. We had parties for children who were orphans. And it was singularly, I will tell you, I could weep thinking about it, the singularly the best experience of my life. The singularly best experience of my life. The first day in Africa where we had 280 kids in a room, and every single one of those kids had lost a parent. Every single one of those children, they were aged 3 to 17 in that room. And my team that you're talking about, I have the greatest team in the world. My team here in the United States had been in contact with the orphanages, so that by the time we got there, we had a present with every child's name on it. This summer, every black doll manufacturer in the country had sent me dolls, because these girls had never seen black dolls. And so it was my mission to do for them what the nuns had done for me, was to let the African girls see a black doll. So I wanted every girl to have a black doll. I wanted every boy to have soccer balls. We bought radios, we bought clothes. And the most important thing is we had their names on every box for every child. And I called up the children one by one. And when those children, you know, received their gifts and then waited for the next child to receive their gifts and said, I said, nobody can open their presents until everybody can open their presents. And on the count of three, when I counted to three, and those children opened their presents, was the single greatest moment of my life. I have a big life, so I can take 50,000 presents and do that over and over and over again to orphanage. But what I felt in that room from those kids is a lot of what you're talking about and what you're talking about and what you see in the faces of those women. When you look into the eyes of someone and you give them a gift, whether that be a physical gift or it be a gift from your spiritual self, from your presence, from the essence of you, and you see the light, you see the joy. What I felt in that room was not just that I was remembered, that the child felt that I was remembered, but you felt a sense of hope, a sense of validation, a sense of validation that somebody cared about me. And I will tell you that of all the years and shows that I have done, and every theme for every show that I've done, the single common denominator that I found that every human being is looking for is validation. Every single person needs to know, wants to feel that they matter, that they matter. And what happened in that room that was the greatest day of my life, I knew that those children knew in that moment that they mattered, that they mattered. And so I encourage you, it's exciting to be able to write a check. It's even more exciting to be able to touch one life, to be able to do that for one person. It's like Cynthia was saying, when you can do that for one person, when you can do that, you will know that your life has meaning. And I will tell you, when I left that place, my friend Gail and I were there, and we're all boo-hooing. We're like boo-hooing with the children. Oh, my God. And Gail was saying, what is it? What is it? We're so full. And Gail said to me, she said, you know, as big as your show is, as big as your show is, what happened in that room seemed bigger. What happened in that room seemed bigger. And that is true. That is true for me, who has this big life in a television show. And I'm telling you, for everybody here, extending yourself beyond your world, your kids, your family, your stuff, and reaching out to somebody who is not like you, somebody who is like you, who is in need. If you are feeling depressed or you are feeling down or you're feeling like things aren't going the way you want them to go in your life, the way you turn that around is to reach outside of yourself to somebody else. Reach outside of yourself to somebody else. It will change you. It will change you.
So it is my intention to fulfill the dream of the Creator. It is my intention to live to the highest calling and be pressed to the mark of the highest calling that I have come to do. And when you can ask the Creator, ask that which made you you, what is your dream for me? I guarantee you, instead of you trying to define the dream, what is your dream for me? If you're able to lean into the dream that the universe and all the forces of light and love and power and grace by all the names that we call God has for you, nobody can touch you. Nobody can touch you.
The child is the dream of its parent, a dream that the parent lives. If you want to learn how to live your dream, just watch your parents. See how it works for them. But that's how it works for all of us. With caring, with passion, with resolve, with commitment, and with determination. That's the easy part. The tough one comes later. The tough part is when you and your dream cannot be distinguished. When you become the dream of not just your parents or yourself, but a point in the journey where you become the dream of a nation. When you become the dream of the choices you made. When your vision echoes in millions of resonating voices across the world, from where there is no looking back. You are the dream. There can be times when it will be or feel impossible to perform. It may feel like a fairy tale. No one said that life is easy. But never be shaken by its adversities. A dream, a vision is not an intangible, unreal, imaginary piece of fiction. A dream has hands. It has feet. It has a body, your hands, your feet, your body. The dream is you, and you are the dream. May the two always remain united in spirit. And if that means a struggle, if that means a fight to finish, so be it. It's not about winning or losing. It's about living a life. If I had been a sportsman, a boxer, athlete, hockey player, cricketer, if I had joined the army, the navy, and the air force, if I had been anything else other than an actor, my parents would still have been happy because I was their dream, no matter what I myself was dreaming to be. Gandhiji said, "Be the change that you wish to see in the world." If I were to add my feelings to it, I'd say, "Be the dream that you wish to see in the world." A dream which is neither mine nor yours nor anyone else's, a dream which belongs only to itself. What you bring to the world are the blessings of your parents, learnings of your teachers, and your dreams. They are precious. Do not trade them for anything in the world. Which brings us to a curious word that has become a part of some kind of jargon. It's a word called career. I'm not quite sure I quite like this word career. Career is literally a dash of speed, like a horse does on a racetrack, bolting at uncontrollable speed without an aim or an objective. Life is not a race course. Life is an order, a discipline. Life is a focus. Life is a purpose. A purpose achieved by virtues which are developed with personal effort. Do not gamble on life. It may not happen twice. A dream, therefore, is much more than a career. The dreams of the parents and the dreams of the child live in one place, remember. That place is called home. Not yours, not mine, not his, not hers, no one person's. A home is always ours, our home. Our dream is our worship. Our vision is our prayer. This is the structure of dreams. This is the bond. This is also the bondage, a bond of love, the bondage of responsibility, be that of a small family or that of a large nation. We are because we dare to dream. We are because we learn to excel. You know, chances are very strong that I could have been in cinema or in any other creative aspect of life without a grounding in education. Education which is in consonance with the belief that what sculpture is to a block of marble, education is to the human soul. We shouldn't aspire towards a graduation degree merely because of peer or parental pressure. We should aspire to become graduates because we feel the need to be complete with the advantage of formal education. Remember always in life, whatever is good to know is difficult to learn. The education of the greatest value that I received in my school, which was Sherwood College up in the hills in Nainital, was how to be a human being, or what we call in shorthand, character. And I don't mean the ones that I play in my films. Admittedly, I had the benefit of inspirational parentage, but Sherwood taught me to live in dignity with my peers, live in a community, and live well with myself in the world at large in consequence. Living together, working together, learning together, fighting and loving each other, competing fairly in noble rivalry and cooperating supportively, I learned a sense of fellowship. So well put in my school motto, which was in Latin, Miriat quisque palmam. Let each one merit their own prize. Let each one merit their own prize. I've always believed that one must harness the power of dignity through training. Training of the mind, the body, and the spirit. Another word for this training is called discipline. I didn't always like to agree with the routine of boarding school and the rules, but afterwards I can tell you, I really appreciated the fact that had it not been for its initially imposed regimen, I could not have learned to harness the power of my own dignity for myself. The boxing ring in my school was a compulsory activity. Everybody in school had to enter the boxing ring and fight. It's now probably a long abolished practice because of its barbaric practice. But to me, it was a great tutor in this regard. You will have any amount of support from outside the ropes, but inside, you're on your own. Similarly, in life beyond, you may have a die-hard corps of cheering fans, and also perhaps those that jeer at you, criticize you, abuse you, in contempt. But at the end of the day, you must engage life alone. The greatest prize in life is not the recognition of worldly success. The prize the best crowns the human being is that of the possession of good character. It is a strenuous prize. It must be re-won. It is also a certainty of mine that there is many a day where I shall fail that prize myself. Not for want of trying, but it is the most worthy prize of all. And without its effort, all material success and fame is sheer emptiness.
performing under pressure, whether it's me or anybody else, is the same. You know, I have the same pressures as anyone else. There's time, there's performance, there's financial. I mean, there, you know, there's deadlines. My pressures are not unique. The situations may be different, or you know, but everybody has the same kinds of pressures. But what I found, or what I find fascinating, is the interpretation of the stimuli. Let me explain. So I was watching the Olympics, this last summer Olympics, and I was amazed at how bad the questions were that the reporters would ask all the athletes. And almost always, they asked the same question, whether they were about to compete or after they competed. Were you nervous, right? And to a T, all the athletes went, no, right? And what I realized is it's not that they're not nervous, it's their interpretation of what's happening in their bodies. I mean, what happens when you're nervous, right? Your heart rate starts to go, you sort of get a little tense, you get a little sweaty, right? You have expectation of what's coming, and we interpret that as, I'm nervous. Now, what's the interpretation of excited? Your heart rate starts to go, you're anticipating what's coming, right? You get a little sort of like tense. It's all the same thing, it's the same stimuli. Except these athletes, these Olympic quality athletes, have learned to interpret the stimuli that the rest of us would say is nervous as excited. They all say the same thing. No, I'm not nervous, I'm excited. And so I've actually practiced it just to tell myself when I start to get nervous that this is excitement, you know? And so I used to speak in front of a large audience and somebody would say, how do you feel? I used to say, a little nervous. Now when somebody says, how do you feel? I'm like, really excited actually. And it came from just sort of telling myself, no, this is excitement. And it becomes a little bit automatic later on. But it's kind of a remarkable thing to deal with pressure by interpreting what your body is experiencing as excitement rather than nerves. And it's really kind of effective. It makes you want to rush forward rather than pull back, and yet it's the same experience. I talk to so many smart, fantastic, ambitious, idealistic, hard-working kids, and they're right out of college, they're in their entry-level jobs, and I'll ask them, how's it going? And they'll say, I think I'm gonna quit. And I'm like, why? They say to me, I'm not making an impact. I'm like, you know you've been here 8 months, right? They treat the sense of fulfillment or even love like it's a scavenger hunt, like it's something you look for. My millennial friends, they've gone through so many jobs. They're either getting fired, I mean it was mutual, or they're quitting because they're not making an impact, or they're not finding the thing they're looking for, or they're not feeling fulfilled, as if it's a scavenger hunt. Love, a job you find joy from, is not something you discover. It's not like, I found love. Here it is. I found a job I love. That's not how it works. Both of those things require hard work. You are in love because you work very hard every single day of your life to stay in love. You find a job that brings you ultimate joy because you work hard every single day to serve those around you and you maintain that joy. It's not a discovery. But the problem is the sense of impatience. It's as if an entire generation is standing at the foot of a mountain. They know exactly what they want. They can see the summit. What they can't see is the mountain. This large, immovable object. That doesn't mean you have to do your time. That's not what I'm talking about. Take a helicopter, climb, I don't care, but there's still a mountain. Life, career fulfillment, relationships are journeys. The problem is, this entire generation has an institutionalized sense of impatience, and do they have the patience to go on the journey to maintain love, to feel fulfilled, or do they just quit and onto the next, dump and onto the next, ghost and onto the next? I'm at my best when I'm around people who believe what I believe. I know it seems silly, but I try very, very hard to sort of stack the deck, you know, to put myself in a position of strength. So for example, you know, somebody asked me just yesterday, have you ever had sort of a bad, you know, engagement? And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, not really. But it's not because I'm some sort of genius or anything like that. It's because I stack the deck. It's because I want to be there. I want to be around people who want me there. In other words, if I'm somebody's 10th choice, you're like, you know, I'll probably turn it down. Whereas if I'm their first choice, they really want me there, and so I'm more likely to have a good engagement. They're supportive of me, I'm supportive of them,
And so, I'm at my best when I stack the deck, when I choose to be in an environment where my strengths are there.
Thank you.